Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
As promised, here's a bonus session of Whiskey Congress. We have Mark and Ben on the phone. Steve and I are together in the Cleveland studio. Ben has been on with us before, and Steve and Ben talk financial stuff all the time that sometimes goes over my head. So, Steve, how you doing today?
Well, I'm good. We've got our buddy Mark and Ben with us on today. He is the lead dog over at Steelyard Capital, right?
Yeah, you got it.
And, hedge fund manager, and you're also the guy to go for great philosophical existential quotes, and an avid sports fan, a big Ohio Bobcat fan. Ben, how are you?
I'm great. Yeah, good to connect with you guys. It's been a minute. I think last time we talked was just after the election. So, a lot to catch up on.
Yeah, I mean, so let's jump into the market and let's kind of go back a little bit, right? Like, so before the election, there was all the debate over, you know, if Trump wins, the market's going to boom. If Biden wins, the market's going to crash. Your analysis was, look, Biden's victory is already priced in. You know, whatever happens, the market is prepared for it. It's not necessarily that the market's going to crash. It's that if it's Biden, then the market's going to go to sectors where they think that, you know, will excel under Biden. If it's Trump, the markets will stay where they're at, where they're excelling under Trump. And so fast forward, Biden wins. We go through everything that we went through with the election and the insurrection and everything else. Things have sort of stabilized. And What are the markets doing now?
Well, printing new highs, right? I mean, we just got over 4,000 on the S&P this past week.
I'm sorry, I'm going to stop you right there. Can you just explain what that means? I guess in as layman terms as possible, because I think people hear it, but when they, you know, if you ask them to explain it, like they their eyes sort of glaze over, like, oh, the S&P is over 4,000. Okay, what is that? You know.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, so just, you know, that's just it's a major index. It's the top, 500 companies, publicly traded companies in the U.S. On an aggregate basis. So the S&P as that index, as that measure, is at its highest point in history. The Dow Jones, which is just an index of 30 companies, so it's a bit more of a narrow index, but also an index that's been recently printing new highs, not quite at a high like the S&P, but very much has been printing new highs as well. It's the NASDAQ, the tech-heavy NASDAQ, that's kind of had some choppiness and had a pretty nasty sell-off through the month of March, and largely due to inflation concerns. I'm sure we can talk a little bit about that. But yeah, ever since the election, we've seen the market pretty much plow higher. To your point, there's been sector rotation for sure. You know, there's been a movement away from growth tech into this, value space, industrials, financials, anything to do with infrastructure potentially. These are the companies that have certainly outperformed. But overall, yeah, the market continues to be quite healthy with just this major dose of choppiness and volatility over the last, 4 or 5 weeks.
And what's interesting is we also just got a jobs report showing that unemployment is falling. And the reason I bring that up is that I think you have to reiterate this, right? That, jobs and labor is separate and different from the market. Right.
Right.
You know, I mean, like our economy is made up of all these sort of things together. But, people want to constantly, and Trump did this a lot where he equated, the jobs and the market, the market's doing great. Look at the jobs and whatever. And then when the jobs report didn't look great, he still would point to the market, sort of kind of exposing himself a little bit. But the two things are separate. But the good news is that the jobs report was good, right? And so that in and of itself could be a boost for the market.
Yeah, I mean, the non-farms payroll, that's the first Friday of every month, is a really important data point. It's often a catalyst, and markets generally move on it. This past Friday was a little unique because, you know, obviously it was Good Friday, so you only had the futures market open until 9:15 a.m. The report comes out at 8:30 a.m. Eastern, so the market really didn't trade on it, but you did get a sense of how the market reacted via the futures. But yeah, more broadly, that non-farms payroll is a very, very important report, and you can really dig into the guts of it. To your point, there's just a treasure trove of data in there when it comes to sector-specific stuff, inflationary measures, for example, average hourly earnings. That's a big kind of inflationary data point, which was very tepid, in fact, this past jobs report. And yeah, a lot of times people just look at the top line, meaning, you know, how many jobs were created versus expectation, or they'll just look at the U3 number, which is the unemployment rate. You know, I'll generally point out the U6 unemployment rate. U6 is actually a truer measure. It actually incorporates disenfranchised workers, or in other words, workers that haven't been able to find a job, that have actually rolled off the measure of U3. So there's all kinds of nuances to the jobs report as well. But yeah, definitely separate than the broader economy. And also keep in mind, it's a backward-looking report, right? So right. It's the stock market is a forward-looking instrument, whereas the jobs report is a backward-looking data measure. So important to just, you know, distinguish the two.
Thank you. Appreciate it. So now we have a sort of understanding of kind of where the market is, right? So the market is booming. We're seeing numbers and highs in the S&P, which is what the Standard & Poor's, right?
That's
S&P. Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Dow Jones is booming. NASDAQ, you know, jumped back a little bit. So I guess the question is now, you know, we saw this crazy thing happen with, you know, GameStop and AMC and Reddit, and it just created a firestorm. Right. And I thought about bringing you on in the midst of it. But I knew, one, you were busy. Two, I just kind of wanted it to play out. Now, I followed what you were saying on Twitter pretty closely.
Yeah.
I also predicted, like, when it really hit the fan, before I saw what you were going to say, I predicted what you were going to say. Right. Like that. OK, guys, this is fun and neat and cool. And right. But eventually it's going to blow up, and you know, the guys who kind of started this, they started with more money than you think, more money than most of you have, so they'll be fine. And those of you jumping in late, doing all sorts of crazy shit with naked options and everything else, you're going to get burned, and that's kind of what happened.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the GameStop scenario was a pretty interesting one. it kind of is the crescendo that was reached post-COVID, and you know, in past discussions you guys have had with me, we've talked about just this elevated options activity dynamic that's continued to persist. It's actually cooled off a bit in the past few weeks for a litany of reasons. I'm sure we can get into some of those, but you know, options being inherently leveraged instruments, you know, it does create ripples across the market. And when you started to see the coordinated buying of deep, you know, way out of the money call options, in other words, people making leveraged bets that a stock was going to go in a certain direction, in this case, very coordinated in a small cap name like GameStop or AMC or Costs, et cetera, you can move those names pretty substantially, because as you buy out of the money naked call options, the broker dealers that are actually writing the contracts, and Steve, you'll remember last time we talked about, you know, the covered call strategy, which, right. You know, essentially you're the casino and mm-hmm. you're selling the lottery tickets to the bettors, the, I guess, the greater fool's theory, right? Mm-hmm. The next guy coming in that wants to take that bet. What ends up happening is that, you know, these broker dealers have to actually hedge their position. So they actually end up buying the shares. And so when those shares begin to squeeze higher and the crescendo kind of reaches a climax with the out of the money call buying, you know, the thing gets squeezed higher and higher and higher. And of course, you know, these are insane valuations of what some of these names were trading at. I think GameStop almost got to $500 a share. It's really, let's be honest, a $10 stock.
Right.
Same thing with AMC. You know, it got up to the, what, $16, $17, $18 range. So yeah, that was a really interesting thing. And what's funny that you bring that up is because it's not that I was particularly busy during that time, but the market was certainly very active. And I actually had during that time joined this social media app called Clubhouse. And the reason I joined it was to speak about this specifically because there was a ton of activity of people discussing these squeezes, just like you see with Wall Street Bets. And so for me, it was fascinating because if you can imagine what we're talking about, but it's like a live drop in audio platform, just like, you know, Twitter or Spaces is trying to do. This is what Clubhouse was all about. So for me, it was fascinating to talk to all these investors, many of which were rookie investors, young investors that were participating in the squeeze, not really understanding the mechanics of the market or the depth of book or liquidity or any of these concepts as to how they would exit those trades. And that was what was fascinating for me from a perspective standpoint. But yeah, that choppiness began at the end of January, and we've seen it persist here into March now into April.
And you know what's interesting? I think the key to what you just said was the exit strategy, right? Like everybody was so, you know, just amped to jump in, right?
Yeah.
And I tried as much as I could, you know, as people were coming in. Listen, I'm nowhere near, I don't have nearly the knowledge that you do, or I don't consider myself a knowledgeable investor, but I knew enough to say, look, if you're doing this, you need to have a plan, right? You have right. You have to say when this gets to X number, you know, in terms of whether it's going up or down, you got to know when to jump out, right? If whether it's going your way or it's going the wrong way, because if you don't, right, that thing could skyrocket and then it could retrace and kick you all, you know what I mean? And you lose everything.
Right.
And unfortunately, I had a number of people who lost, you know, every penny that they invested, they lost. And because they didn't know when to pull out, and they had no way to identify when things were starting to work against them. And there were, you know, through technical analysis, fundamental and that sentiment, there's a number of different ways where you can't maybe pinpoint it. But you can start to get a feel and say, you know what, it's even if you don't have a set time, you can go ahead and say, all right, I got to get out. And so many people didn't. And I felt bad. But, I, you know, you tried to tell them and a lot of people didn't listen. They were just so blinded by, I think, the sensationalism that was sort of created in the media.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's you know, you've heard me say this so many times in our past conversations. It's easy to know what to buy. It's very hard to know when to sell. And that always rings true. And of course, it rang true in this particular situation. So yeah, in terms of exit strategy, just in terms of implied volatility, which I'm not sure a lot of people even understand what that measure means.
Right.
And that was a major component of what was happening in those particular names at that time. And to your point, Steve, you'd hear people using things like diamond hands and, you know, like the old Bitcoin hold or, you know.
What the hell's a diamond hand?
Diamond hands, it's a phrase people use when you hold a stock for an extended period of time and you don't worry about the dips and you stay true to your research and you say this is, you know, this stock is going to hit 600, you know, from 100 and you figure it's going to happen in a certain amount of time, you hold it, and then when it hits that expected number, then you sell and you make the profits and you seem like a genius. That's the term that they use.
Okay.
And it got some people in trouble.
And by the way, Jim, that's like a Wall Street Bets lingo. I guess that's where it emerged from. And so, yeah, if you think of diamonds, like diamonds are hard, right? They become hard over pressure and time.
Right.
And
stuff. Okay.
And that's diamond hands meaning like strong hands, whereas you don't have paper hands, as they call it. Paper hands meaning you're weak. And you'll sell it at any sign of weakness. And to Steve's point, I mean, that's the bigger issue that I kind of thought, particularly with interacting with a lot of these younger investors through the Clubhouse app. And I'm talking, we'd have rooms of hundreds, thousands of people in these rooms in real time discussing these issues. And, you know, to that point, you know, the diamond hand strategy was largely these options traders. And they did, to Steve's point, they don't understand that this can go to zero. It's different when you own the underlying stock. Then, I mean, those go to zero as well, but obviously not in the same accelerated time frame that an options contract would if you're not rolling or doing other types of, you know, I guess more advanced strategies. But yeah, it was really just crazy to see. I think a lot of lessons were learned, hopefully. But one of the interesting things I was actually sharing with my community over the weekend here is we have started to see options activity as a share of total volume start to roll over a little bit. And with that, obviously, the market is stabilized. So I do think there's a correlation there. But the biggest chop that's been meaningful in the market over the last several weeks has been this inflation concern. And obviously, a lot of eyes are on the treasury yields. There's been a ton of selling in the bond market. So as you see the treasury yields, particularly the 10-year, really skyrocket in a very short period of time, that's why largely why you've seen like the growth trade, like tech, for example, which is very disproportionately, in fact, susceptible to inflation due to discounted cash flow models. And, you know, how do you value a business that's based on, a growth model that's obviously impacted by cost of capital and inflation, and so if those dollars
possibly
that
not
making today
profiting
are worth
money
less in the future due to inflation, you have to bake that into your valuation in the current day. And so that's largely why the tech trade, for example, the QQQ trade or the NASDAQ, has really been damaged by this inflation concern. And again, I say inflation concern because the 10-year, I think we closed on Friday, still about a 1.68, 1.69, somewhere around there, which is really historically not a huge number. It's just the pace at which we got there. We went from, spot 8.1, spot 8.2, all the way up to, this 1.6 and 1.7 range. And probably you're going to go over 2. And so there's kind of been a process of the market to digest that. So that's, and we could get into the weeds on that too if you guys want, but that's really what the big dynamic right now in the market is fear of inflation.
If you could explain what those numbers mean, that would probably help. Like, what does 1.6 to 2 mean?
Yeah, so that's the actual yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury bond.
Gotcha.
So as bond investors, owners of those assets, as they get concerned about inflation, holding U.S. Treasury notes is not as attractive as it would be otherwise. So they start to sell those, basically trying to force the hand of the Fed to raise the interest rate. Because right now, as you know, we've been at pretty much 0.25 basis points, since the bottom of the COVID issue from last March. So when I talk about 1.6 or 1.7 on a 10-year, that means the treasury yield. So the price of the bond itself is actually falling. People are selling bonds, and as the bonds sell off, their yields go higher, and that's generally perceived and digested as an inflationary indicator. And so for the growth in tech trade, especially for companies that are negative earnings, right? So negative EPS companies, they're really susceptible to that, because even if they've got great proprietary technology, even if they've got a great trajectory with sales and revenue, they're very susceptible to inflation because, like I said, the discounted cash flow models, which is a pretty common way to value stocks, that really suffers from an inflationary environment. And again, as I mentioned earlier, stocks are a forward-looking instrument. So even though inflation isn't present today in terms of material data terms, there are, kind of whiffs of it and, kind of suggestions that it could materialize. So that's why the stock market kind of got a little jumpy, particularly with the NASDAQ, not so much Dow and S&P.
Ben, let me ask a personal question, related to me. I'm scheduled to possibly refinance my house because interest rates are so low, and refinancing makes sense for me right now. Right. Inflation would be a terrible thing for me if I don't act quickly, right? Because if there's inflation, then those rates, lending rates for homes and everything else go up.
Right.
So what I'm hearing from you is, if that's something I want to do, don't fool around for a couple months and wait, because those numbers could change dramatically, and a couple percentage points a quarter of a percentage point or a half a percentage point makes a huge difference in the value of refinancing. Yes or no?
Well, it could. I mean, I think that, when we talk about personal finance, and it depends on so many factors, right? Like the size of your mortgage, for example, but a quarter point on an interest rate on a mortgage loan in terms of its cost to you over time seems like a lot, but in terms of a monthly payment is pretty, it's it's not really substantial, but you're absolutely right. The anticipation is that rates will continue to go up. So refinancing, particularly if you're, you know, if you're on a 30 year that's, you know, over, you know, 4.5% or something like that. Yeah, I think you probably do want to seriously consider refinancing, because rates are anticipated to go higher. And that's not just the bond market. It's not just the Fed. It's the way these mortgage-backed securities are priced. And I think that that's a safe assumption to think that a year from now, we're going to see a 30-year mortgage probably closer to maybe 4.25% than it is today, which is, you know, let's call it 3.5 to 3.75.
Okay, I didn't want to derail things. I just wanted to put that out there. Here's what you're putting in my head.
It's all interrelated.
And so I think the big thing to take away from it is, like, so if you want to refi your house, then you want to do it now. You want to do it much sooner than later. I don't think you're going to see as a dramatic jump as you sort of indicated within the next couple months, but you definitely don't want to put it off because, you know, it's going to raise. It's going to go up over time. And then if you, you know, we could be a year from now and you say, oh, yeah, I want to refinance my house, then the rates may still be lower than what they were when you initially bought your home, but you just, you may have cost yourself a fair amount of money or, you know, lost some savings on your monthly payment because of the delay. So, right. You know, tell your credit union to get on their shit.
You know, and one other factor, too, to keep in mind is that banks' lending appetite has changed as well. In fact, particularly if it's a cash out refi, there's a lot of banks that simply stopped doing cash out refis during the, you know, some of the depths of the COVID issue. So that could be a factor as well. Certainly with regard to HELOC products and just accessing your equity absent a total refi, those have largely been curtailed by major banks. That'll likely change, but I think rates would need to get more attractive for those programs to come back. So that could be a factor as well, depending on your situation.
Okay. Again, I didn't mean to jump the tracks. I just wanted to
put that out there. No, it's all related stuff. It's all good.
So now we've got like a kind of a good view of kind of what's going on with the market and possibly where it's going. You know, let's talk about some sort of, interesting, I don't know if I want to call them anomalies or what they are, but, you know, this new thing has kind of hit the scene in the form of NFTs. And they're just, to me, they're really bizarre, right? They're, you know, these just sort of random things that didn't, up until it feels like a month ago, didn't have value. And now people are paying crazy exorbitant amounts for them. And mostly, you know, digital assets, but other things. Can you talk about what NFTs are and sort of what role you see them playing, going forward? Because it's hard to say if they would play a role in the market or what, but like what are we looking at here with NFTs?
Sure. So NFTs are part of the blockchain ecosystem. It's an acronym that stands for non-fungible token. And the best way, I guess, to describe it is it's basically a digital certificate of authenticity, so to speak. In terms of its use case, it's mostly been in the art, fine art, and music space. I think it's, I mean, I don't mean to say hilarious. I do mean to say hilarious.
What you mean to say, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, to me, it's just completely insane that, that there are people interested in these as an investment vehicle. To me, it may have some interesting use case, like I said, in art and collectibles and things like that. But there are people that I can tell you this just knowing firsthand that are interested in it as an investment vehicle. In fact, there are U.S. equities that have exposure to this stuff, and they've been insanely volatile as a result. I think when it comes to use cases, that's the interesting thing about NFTs. I've heard that they could potentially supplant like title work on a house or any kind of contracts, all kinds of legal documentation that could potentially be supplanted with the technology. So there are those potential use cases, but as it stands today, it's a highly speculative risk asset that, yeah, there are people putting money behind it as an investment vehicle, which I think is ill-advised.
And what's interesting, I guess we could tie it to Bitcoin to a degree, right? Bitcoin mm-hmm. is built on the blockchain sort of idea. And, you know, I was talking to Jim earlier that, you know, for me, Bitcoin, when you look at it, you know, right now, what are people really using Bitcoin for? Money laundering, buying things illegally, buying things on secondary markets, trying to avoid, the tax evasion, sort of things like that, mostly things that are not quite above board. And I don't necessarily have anything against any of those things. I mean, however you get off is how you get off, right? I don't judge. But
that's not entirely true, but okay.
But, you know, in terms of, you know, like, so we see Bitcoin, we see the value of it. You know, one coin is tens of thousands of dollars right now. I don't see a great use for Bitcoin, but the issue is that, look, if you dropped $100 into Bitcoin, 10 years ago, then that $100 is worth a fair amount of cash right now in that world. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, so Bitcoin's been pretty interesting. I think when we spoke last, because I know over the summer, it was actually the first time I ever got exposure to Bitcoin. I've since rolled out of it. Because I do think that there are certain cycles that have emerged with Bitcoin. Now you bring up an interesting point about use case. It's certainly not a efficient or viable currency, right? In terms of, why would you buy something today when the means by which you're buying it could double in value in, a matter of days or weeks, or potentially go the other way. So it's not a useful currency to that extent. But the use case about using it as a store of wealth, quote unquote, or a digital gold, essentially, is an interesting one. I do expect Bitcoin, however, and this is just my own personal opinion. I mean, take this for what it's worth. It's certainly not financial advice, but I've generally been pretty good at predicting these trends in Bitcoin. If you'll remember, I went back in 2017, called the top when it first hit 20,000 and all the way back down to about 3,000. I do think Bitcoin's going to roll back lower. Now, there are institutions that are getting behind this. There's obviously some ETFs and so forth on the way that have direct exposure to Bitcoin. But my sense is that you're going to see Bitcoin roll back into the maybe $40,000 to $30,000 ranges. And I think that's where it's going to become more interesting to put on a new position. I'm currently, when it got to around 60,000 is about, it pretty much, felt like it had gone through a, kind of a bull cycle. So Bitcoin, I think, will continue to be a little choppy, of course, but it's definitely I'm not a big crypto enthusiast. I do think in terms of diversification of portfolio, it does make sense to have some exposure. And like I said, I kind of took my first dip into it back in August of this past year, 2020. And, it turned out to be a decent trade. However, I do worry about the folks that are, kind of not taking a diversified approach to it and kind of just like the maximalists or whatever they call them, the cultists, whatever, that are just diving into Bitcoin. And that's, that's the end all be all. It is going to continue to be choppy. I do think there's going to be a bit of a flush out. I think you do want to be poised and from a positioning standpoint, be ready to take advantage of it if it is an area of interest for you. But yeah, Bitcoin is an interesting place. And I do think you'll see further consolidation in terms of, shit coins or whatever you want to call them, altcoins. kind of consolidating into just Bitcoin. Now, of course, Ethereum's an interesting one because, you brought up NFTs, Steve. My understanding is that NFTs are largely built on the Ethereum blockchain. And so Ethereum seems to have an interesting use case when it comes to these NFTs and potentially like smart contracts and things like that. So I think that's why you've seen some, some firming up of the Ethereum space. But eventually, I think this stuff kind of whittles down into, just the coins with the best use case. And you won't see all of these, these kind of ancillary, I call them shit coins or whatever you want to call them. But that's going to, I think that's going to materialize here in the next, years, to potentially decades.
Shitcoin is far from the most clever thing I've ever heard, but it made me laugh, obviously. And I don't know if you invented that term.
I call them shitcoins too when people are asking about penny stocks and stuff. Okay. That's another dynamic we haven't talked about is just, the elevated activity going on in penny stocks, right? Which is just something that's kind of been running concurrent to the GME and AMC squeeze. There's been a huge spike in volume in, you know, penny stocks. These are, you know, small micro cap companies that generally trade either OTC, meaning over the counter, or in the pinks market, that are generally well under $5 per share. And, you know, that's been another crazy area of speculation. So all of these kind of, you know, they reek of like market tops. So I do think defensive is the way to be right now. This was something I talked about back in January. And, you know, like I said, we'll continue to see some chop. But again, you see like the S&P, for example, just defying gravity. And we'll see where it goes, because this infrastructure package is on the way. Again, as we digest this kind of inflationary dynamic and kind of process it, I think the markets, particularly the NASDAQ and the tech and growth trade, have an opportunity to go higher. Because again, if you go back to 2017, 2018, I mentioned to you, Jim, you know, 1.6, 1.7 yield on the 10-year. Back then, the QQQ or the NASDAQ or whichever you want to look at, the tech trade was doing really, really well. And the 10-year was at that time like 3.25% on the 10-year. So more than double where it is today in terms of yield. So, you know, I think as we digest that, tech trade has an opportunity to kind of revert back to the mean, which, you know, it's been oversold. I think that's where I think the growth trade is largely back, as evidenced by the last 4 or 5 trading sessions.
You know, one of the things I think I have to reiterate, and I take away from a lot of what you're saying, and I try to talk to people about, is you can't fall in love with any one particular sector, and you have to be open-minded enough to diversify, you know, across different sectors and looking at new technology and looking at, you know, whether it's a Bitcoin or, you know, looking at NFTs, recognizing there's too much risk there, there's not enough there to met it out, you know, but not, like, I think sometimes people see something that's booming like a Bitcoin and say, all right, I'm going to be the guy who gets rich off of this one thing, and they're going to drive into that, you know, head first, blinders on. And if you're, you know, you want to be a successful, smart investor, that you just don't go into anything. That's just not the way to operate.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, it's important to remember this. Just because it's a great company that has great technology doesn't make it a great stock. And that's just really hard for people to understand. I mean, again, if you look at, for example, I'm sure you've probably heard of Cathie Wood and her ARK Invest. ETFs that are comprised of all these companies with disruptive technology, many of which are fascinating, really, really great, you know, next generation companies, particularly her exposure in like the biotech space and, you know, genomics and, you know, human gene editing and all kinds of just crazy next level technologies that are really meaningful and have really compelling use cases. But that doesn't make them great stocks. And you're absolutely right. You can't fall in love necessarily with certainly not with single name stocks, but also to your point with sectors. I mean, listen, there's nothing sexy about, you know, rolling out of a really cool cloud or AI or robotics trade into like an infrastructure play, right? Like, like a Martin Marietta or something, right? Yeah. This like concrete company.
Cliff, sir.
There's nothing sexy about that trade, you know, right. But it's profitable. And that's that, you know, when people have heard so much about, you know, quote unquote rotation, which has been occurring over the last, you know, 7-8 weeks. Saw a lot of head fakes towards rotation back at the end of 2020 and into 2021, but we didn't see follow through until, you know, into February and January. But rotation just meaning market money is not coming out of the market, but institutional investors are rolling money out of certain sectors and into others. And in this case, it was out of tech and out of cloud and out of AI, out of software as a service, and into either value, financials, energy, all of the areas that gotten the shit kicked out of it from the March lows that just never rebounded back the way tech did. And so, yeah, some of those trades are not sexy at all. I mean, there's nothing sexy about owning Caterpillar or John Deere or Honeywell, you know, but those are the names that are going to outperform in a value rotation, and obviously also with a potential infrastructure plan on the way.
Right. So, and I guess part of it too is just like, look, do you want to make money, or do you want to stake the claim of being the smartest guy in the room, right? With nothing to really prove it. And I think if you've got blinders on, you're saying, okay, I'm just gonna ride Bitcoin until, you know, unknown time, or, you know, it's just like every penny stock that comes out, that's the one you're gonna jump into, or, you know, it's all tech all the time, and you're a Tesla fanboy, whatever it might be. Like, this is where people get themselves in trouble, and you just have to recognize that the market isn't static, right? Like, what's hot right now is not going to be hot in 6 months or 12 months or 2 years, and you have to be nimble enough to be able to move with it. And if you're not, then you either need to have someone else manage your portfolio, or you need to, you know, get out of this and get into real estate.
Yeah, or just diversify and take a passive strategy. I think that's the best option for most people. But you're totally right. And I think you really nailed it earlier when you said, you know, people are looking for that get rich quick type of thing, because, you know, it goes back to the mania behind Bitcoin early on, when, you know, people are talking about Lambos and going to the moon and stuff. And now it's with the same thing with NFTs, and it was the same thing with some of this, you know, these tech sectors, where people just thought, hey, man, I'm piling into this trade. It's a no-brainer. It's the easiest trade out there. And you know, it, like I said, it very well could be a great trade. It could be a great company, but that doesn't make it a great stock or a great investment. And I think that's the main issue, is that people are very impatient. And to our earlier point, many of these quote-unquote investors, I would call them punters or gamblers, are coming in and just using options as their main strategy, as opposed to buying underlying shares and putting on a strategy that's augmented with options. Keep in mind, you know, options are intended to be derivatives. It's a strange thing in the market when options volume starts to surpass that of equities themselves. You know, when stocks become the derivative of options, you have a market that's malfunctioning. And that part, I think, what, like I said, with options cooling off a little bit, I think that is correcting itself. But
do you think that there's an intentional push back from, you know, some of the larger investors, bigger firms, against, like, the naked option group, right? Like, it's just like, all right, we got all these people coming in on Robinhood or whatever the app may be, and they're doing all these naked options, and they're buying out the money. Let's just sell, kill, you know, anyone who's buying a call. Let's just crush them until they're out, and then things stabilize, and we can kind of get back to normal. Do you think that there's any sort of, do you think there's any intent behind it, kind of targeted at the naked option crew, or do you think that this is just sort of naturally occur, like the selling off is just part of the rotation, and the naked option people are just kind of sort of getting caught in the wash just because?
Oh yeah, no. There's no deliberate attempt from institutions to, like, entice people to buy out of the money naked calls at all. It's just organically happening because, like I said, and to your point, people are chasing those big gains, and they're hearing about people that are making these big gains, at least paper gains. A lot of them don't have the discipline to necessarily exit the position, even if they can find somebody on the other side of the trade with some of these contracts. But yeah, not at all, because keep in mind, I mean, you know, people talk about wealth inequality and this major disparity when it comes to wealth distribution. And keep in mind, you know, when you go to zero on that options contract, it didn't just go to money heaven. It went to these institutions that sold you the contracts. And so it amplifies that wealth disparity. So this whole stick it to the man trade, trying to squeeze a GME or an AMC again, it's just fucking stupid. I mean, it completely amplifies the very dynamic that people are trying to strike out against. And so, no, I don't think it's a deliberate attempt to crush the naked call options buyer. It's the naked call options buyer that's literally running off the end of a cliff, and they just don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so, of course, if you don't know what you're doing in this type of a market, well, in any type of a market, you know, the sharks are going to find it. They're going to smell the blood, and they're going to eat you up.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting. And I don't know if that dynamic is fully played itself out. like I said, when you look at total options volume, equities and indexes, in fact, it started to roll over a little bit. And I largely think it is because, I mean, of course, there's the little bumps with the stimmy checks and stuff like that. But I do think a lot of these people, to your point, Steve, have gone to zero. And it's how many times can you go to zero before you're out of money? And this whole stick it to the man trade, you know, you can't stick it to the man when you're broke.
Right. I mean, you can yell at him all you want, but yeah, no, I mean, and, you know, from a personal investment standpoint, I just, my personal situation, I got so busy with work, you know, my actual day job that makes money, that I had to kind of look at my trading activity and move a lot of money into long-term assets just because I just didn't have the time or frankly the energy to keep up with, you know, trading options, right? I mean, because everything happens so fast, you know, and I was trying to, you know, kind of juggle both and, you know, was having some success, but just recognized that I was going to either burn out or end up being one of those people that went to zero, and I didn't want either of those things. So I took a fair amount of money, moved them, you know, moved it into, you know, my long-term assets and throughout the portfolio. And then I kept, you know, some money on the side in case I do see something or I get an itch and say, all right, let's, you know, let's give this a whirl based off of, you know, a certain amount of information that makes sense.
Yeah, which was smart. I mean, and you're totally right. And you know, I remember when you and I talked about this, I think during our last conversation, you know, it does require a lot of bandwidth to trade options because these things are, like I said, inherently leveraged instruments, right? One contract worth 100 shares and a lot of this out of the money stuff. I mean, the further out of the money you are, the lower the delta, right. Meaning the rate of change of the options, the value of the options contract relative to the underlying security, the stock itself. The closer you are to the money, the higher the delta, the more that changes. But of course, the more expensive that premium is, the closer to the money you are. So these options strategies, they're pretty complex. And again, I just want to reiterate this. Options are generally intended to be instruments that augment your core long or short strategy, meaning you own or you're short underlying names, whatever, how big your book is. Some guys run 6, 7, 10 names. Some guys run 30, 35 names. But you're using options to augment those strategies instead of the other way around because it does, to your point, Steve, it requires so much bandwidth because the dynamics are constantly changing and you have to look at depth of book, you know, who's going to be on the other side of that trade when you're ready to exit. I mean, Steve, this is going to blow your mind. I was in a clubhouse room this about 4 or 5 weeks ago and there was a young man that came into this room and he had bought a GameStop options at an $800 strike price.
Oh no.
Okay.
No.
And
he
bought
did
them
not.
Like ahead of the squeeze. So he was actually he did fairly well.
Well, yeah, if he bought them, because it got up there.
He bought them when GameStop was trading like I think in the 20s or something like that. I don't remember exactly where the underlying was trading when he bought it. But this was a young kid. I think he was like 17 or 18 years old. I'm not 100% sure. Just for legal reasons, let's say he was 18. And he was like pounding his chest about how great of a stock move it was. And I think he claimed to have made a couple $100,000 on the contract sum, which I obviously was clearly bullshit. I actually looked at the options chain and there was like 10 contracts that traded it. Unless he bought all 10 contracts and he got in at like a crazy low premium. But the point is, he, like others, were just that who don't understand market liquidity, who don't understand depth of book, were just buying these things like lottery tickets. And in the very few cases where they would perform well, what they would do is share like, you know, their snapshot of their Robinhood account. And that would go viral with their communities and stuff. Of course, paper gains, they didn't lock any of that in. Even if they wanted to lock it in, they probably couldn't because I'm not sure there was enough depth at those strikes.
Right, to be able
and so it makes everybody think like, hey, oh my God, you can look how much money you can make trading options. And so it's just this negative feedback loop that's really dangerous.
Yeah. Sounds like the Jake Paul of investing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great example. Yeah. It's just scary. But you do need to be careful. And, you know, if it doesn't seem right, if it seems too good to be true, 100% of the time it is. You know, making money in the stock market is not easy. If anybody tells you it is, they're lying to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the more frustrating things you hear. You know, people. I would post some things in my Instagram stories. You know, as I was kind of moving through, and then I started to kind of get a lot of direct messages about, you know, other people and what they were doing, and what I was seeing and hearing were just a lot of things that were just really, just dangerous, right? But the problem is that going through and telling a person, like, listen, what you're doing is stupid. What you're doing, you're gonna lose all your money. Like, you're literally gambling at a casino where you have, you know, less than 1% chance of winning. And people typically don't like to be told that what they're doing is bad or wrong or not gonna yield the result that they have decided it's going to yield. So I stopped, you know, sharing mine because I was like, am I a part of the problem? Right. Like, so I stopped sharing it, but I still have people that will talk to me about it. And I'm like, look, one, go talk to a professional. Two, based off what you're telling me, I don't think this is a good idea. But you know, you're an adult, do what you want. But a lot of times they would reference people's screenshots from this whole GameStop fiasco. Right. And just like, well, this guy did it and this woman did it and this, like, you don't know what they actually did. You don't know what that screenshot is from. You don't know if that's even their account. Like, aside from the fact that people were just showing what they were gaining, but they weren't showing what they did once they exited. Right. Like, so when did you exit? And then how much money did you make or lose once you exited? Like, that's where it matters. Right. And if you can't show me that, then the rest of it doesn't matter. That danger part, right, of people just being blinded by the you know, quick hitter lottery is the part it's unfortunate, right? Because I just, you know, a good friend of ours lost a fair amount of money, and he's, you know, a little more hard-headed, so it's hard to have that conversation with him. But it's just, you know, I mean, it's an unfortunate situation, and you wish that people, like, before you trade, like there's just, there needs to be, you know, I almost wish it was like driving a car, right? Like, you got to at least pass this test, you know, before you get in there and just start. Yes, it's your money and you can do it with it what you want, but just to protect you from you, right, you need to do these certain things first, and you need to show that you're proficient at them, because otherwise, you know, you are the person making other people rich and kind of pushing apart that wealth gap.
Yeah. No, there's something called, and I've shared this with other people too, there's something called the Dunning-Kruger effect. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's
not.
It's kind of a psychological, kind of sociological type of phenomenon that happens when, you know, people that are new to something, they have early success and they immediately think that they are very adept at this, and they way overestimate their capabilities and aptitude in these areas. And that has been rampant in the stock market, particularly with options traders, where, look, you know, it's been a pretty one-way trade since the lows of March, right? The post-COVID lows, where, you know, a lot of these trades have worked, and they worked for a pretty extended period of time. And so people start to think that they really know what they're doing. I mean, fuck, Steve, I can tell you, I've seen people literally selling quote unquote options courses, right? People with no idea what they're doing, right? They couldn't tell you anything about depth of book. I mean, let alone, you know, Greeks or implied volatility, any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But they're like literally selling courses to people on how to trade options when they've only known options as simply like, you know, naked strategies, let alone like, you know, contours or straddles or any of these more, you know, kind of.
I could teach you how to sell options in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, here's
garden geckos. They don't know preferred stock from livestock.
You know, here's a 7-page ebook on how to sell options or how to, you know, buy and trade options.
it's insane. I mean, everybody all of a sudden thinks that they're Paul Tudor Jones because they stumbled into a couple of good trades post COVID. I mean, give me a break. You know, talk to people that have been trading since the great financial crisis of 07, 08. Those are going to be people that will give you really great perspective because they went through the taper tantrum of 2013. They went through the tough sell-off in 2016. And boy, the quarter four 2018 sell-off was a brutal one to trade through. Talk to people like that that have been through this stuff. But the kids that have poured into the market post-COVID, and like I said, they now they're T-Boone Pickens because they managed to cobble together a couple good trades. It's a scary thing, and you hate to see it. I mean, I don't want to see these kids go broke. And I've done my best, right? I mean, to try and share some of this knowledge and try to get, you know, share best practices. But, you know, some people, they don't know the stove's hot until they touch it. And that's just the way it is.
And I think part of it, too, is you have this whole – I think part of it is the options, but you mix that with e-commerce and how easy it is to set up a business online to sell a product that you don't have to house or wear, right? It's an ebook, you store it online. And I think that's what kind of gets us to this point, right? Like, it's just like, oh, okay, I've had, you know, and you can really question if people have even made these successful trades, right? Have they actually made them, or have they traded some options? They've seen some other people make some trades. They have some images or some screenshots to show. And then, you know, writing an ebook, like, anyone can do it. There are literally, you know, there are companies out there who just have ebooks already written that you can buy the rights to. You know, so when you mix that with this sort of kind of phenomenon of naked option buying and things like that, and you put the two together, I think you really have a sort of a dangerous combination where people can lose and will lose a lot of money unnecessarily.
100%. And it's all fueled by again, I mentioned the Dunning-Kruger effect. You combine that with greed, and you've got a really dangerous soup right there. And listen, I can tell you firsthand, I know a lot of these younger traders that have gotten absolutely slaughtered in the month of March, because not only were they using these types of, like, really aggressive option strategies, but they were choosing names that were very much susceptible to these inflation concerns that we talked about earlier. So they were really using the growth names, the tech names, the cloud names, and those have gotten severely punished over the last 5 to 6 to 7 weeks.
Right.
So these guys have gotten wiped out. Just like you said, you've got a friend that got wiped out. I know plenty of people that have gotten wiped out. And, you know, they're finally, I mean, if there's any good silver lining, I guess, to it, you know, they are coming back down to earth and saying, hey, I might actually need to learn about this stuff before I do that again. and that's good, because you want them to be participants in the market on a long-term basis. The problem is, like I said, it's hard to be a market participant when you're broke.
Yeah.
So if you lost all your money, and, you know, and again, it didn't go to money heaven, it went to these big shops that are writing you the contracts, you're not exactly helping your cause to stick it to the man.
Right. It's not like rain where it gets evaporated and then, you know, it comes back down after a while. Like, it's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. I mean, those people can't put on those trades, right?
Yeah, it's in someone else's pool.
Yeah. So, all right, man. Well, look, I really enjoyed the conversation today.
Do you want to do some Tesla talk?
No, I think, I mean, we're good. I mean, I think it was, you know, Tesla is what it is, you know. It's a company that's highly valued, that I think certain people don't feel it should be as valued as it is, but it is, and it will be until it's not. And, you know, it's Elon Musk. Well, they're innovative.
Well, you know what? I'll make a quick comment on Tesla just before we, if that's cool, because, you know, I in fact, Steve, I think the last time we did get together on this podcast, we talked about Tesla. And we talked about EV in general and just some of the other opportunities like battery technology and charging adjacencies and things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, you look at a company like QuantumScape that's really had a lot of choppiness. The thing was way up and now way down and seems to have found a level. But then there's Blink and ChargePoint and all those other things. Don't sleep on some of these legacy EOM manufacturers like GM and Ford. These are the guys that have the opportunity to scale. They've got the dealership networks. So they've got routes to market. But certainly from a manufacturing standpoint and just economies of scale, unit economics, I think these are the guys that are really interesting. I mean, Tesla, to your point, it's well off its highs. I think it's trading in the 600 handle range. I think it was as high as, what, like 800 or something like that. I still like Tesla. I mean, in terms of its intellectual property and its kind of a stature in that space, I don't necessarily like it as a stock to own, but it's an interesting company. But this EV space, what everybody's frothing at the mouth to find opportunity in EV, and, you know, there's been, what was it recently, Fisker, and, you know, I just saw the Nikola guy sold a bunch of his shares. That was a pretty much a scam.
Yeah.
you got to be careful in the EV space, but don't sleep on these old school legacy manufacturers like Ford and GM.
Well, GM is really like the GM is one that's really kind of stuck out to me because we haven't seen what they're going to do, but obviously they've been marketing it very heavy. And, you know, we saw, you know, sort of a glimpse of this new EV Hummer. But to what you're saying, you know, I've argued with people about this, you know, at length. And the reason where everything that you just said, it's just like, look, you know, first of all, you know, Tesla doesn't have the corner on this market, right? Like there are other people, like, you know, the EV technology is evolving, but the, Tesla doesn't, you know, have a monopoly on all the scientists that are working on it. And we don't even know if they have the best technology. We know that it's very good and we know that people like it. But there are other people who have either contributed to Tesla that are now working for GM and other places or vice versa. And it's a big hodgepodge of information and there's competition. Right now, GM, Ford, and these other companies recognize that they need to move in that direction. That eventually we're going to get off of fossil fuels as the fuel to power our automobiles and how we get around. And so, I'm very curious to see with what GM is coming out, just because they're the ones that are probably closest of the old guard. And I'm not saying that I'm invested heavily, but I did. You know, pick up on them, right? And it seemed like this is the time to do it because, you know, when they unveil what their kind of plan is for their platform, I think a big part of that will be what do your cars actually look like, right? Are they these little Prius shits, right? Are they these little cars that just don't look anything like what we're used to? And whenever companies do that, you're always going to have that guy that wants it. Well, I like it because it's unique. Like, okay, great. Go enjoy your piece of shit that looks terrible. Right. But like, you always have that guy. But really, like, you want something that the masses can look at, right? Like, I'm a truck guy. So give me a truck that looks like my Ram 1500 right now, but's electric, right? Can they do that? So GM comes through and says, hey, we got your Cadillac Escalade, but it's fully electric. You can charge it where you charge a Tesla or wherever else. I think that's a huge boom for them.
Yeah, I agree 100% with you. And I'm with you on GM. And I do, if I recall correct, last time when we talked about some of the infrastructure and kind of the picks and shovels approach to this, when we talked about charging stations, et cetera, it's interesting because even the charging stations, I think there's an interesting, when you really dive deep into that and you realize, you know, most people that do own EVs are charging mostly at home. I wonder if the charging station, I guess my point is this, I think it'll be more battery swap stations than as opposed to charging stations.
Right.
And so another interesting picks and shovels approach is the battery technology, but also the rare earths that are required to create these batteries, right? So the, you know, the lithium space, you know, all of these industrial metals that are being used, or some of the companies that have the technology that they're using to actually, recycle a lot of these from dead and existing batteries, extracting those rare earths and repurposing them for new battery technology. Those are some really interesting things as well in the EV space. So I totally agree with you. By the way, I thought about this when you just said that we talked about like these little turd, you know, EVs that, you know, are they something that doesn't have quite the luxury and stuff? It reminded me of that old movie, if you remember, from way back 2002, the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report.
Yeah, I love that
movie.
You
got to go back and watch that movie.
Yeah, you were great in that movie.
Well, I say it.
Ben looks funny. Like Tom Cruise is the joke there, folks. I know you get mad when we say that, but I got to do it.
No, but the funny thing is, if you go, that was a movie from 2002, almost 20 years ago. If you go back and watch that movie, it was so forward. It was a Philip K. Dick book, who was in his own right a visionary. But Jesus Christ, did they just nailed so many predictions about what the future would look like. And EV is a big part of that movie.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting thing to watch that movie, realize how long ago it was and all the cues that we've taken and where we've gone, you know, 20 years later. And all of these are investable sectors and principles if you've got the stomach for it and you've got the time horizon for it. But yes, Steve, I think you've been really responsible with the way you've approached, the way you talk about EV. I think it continues to be an interesting opportunity. You just got to, you know, don't fly too close to the sun is my advice for those that are looking to invest in the space.
The reason I hated Minority Report is I didn't want our justice system to come down to three old people in a hot tub, but
that's just me. Would be a little weird. Hopefully that's
You know what though? Maybe it would be an improvement of role.
To your point, just real quick about that movie. I mean, if you look at where we are now with our, facial recognition software, and we've had people talk, people in law enforcement talk with us about, some of the software that's used to respond to predict where, gunfire is going to break out, and then having units there kind of ahead of time. Like there's a lot of things that are starting to sort of kind of come to a keystone in terms of, where that movie kind of said we were going and where we're actually going. Where, is it art imitating life or life imitating art? And it's interesting. I don't, scary. I'm not sure yet, but we're going somewhere, and that movie, picked a lot of the things that we're seeing along the way.
Yeah, and look, you just saw the big contract with Microsoft with the augmented reality headsets for the military.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally, if you can imagine Google Glass, that's just basically a layer of augmented reality over what you're seeing. So data points based on what the, the lenses are processing, just like a Snapchat filter works. It's crazy. And obviously, like the retinal scans and all that stuff when it comes to the, what's the word I'm thinking? When it comes to the, retinal scans,
bioinformatics or?
Oh gosh. Yeah. Something like that. I forget that. I can't believe I forgot the word, but yeah, all that stuff is becoming more and more prevalent. And to your point, all the predictive software and AI being used to supplant it, it's going to be a fascinating 10, 15 years. And again, we've talked in the past about the laws of accelerating returns, the Ray Kurzweil principle, and we are seeing things move at exponential rates. And it is hard to get your mind around exponential change versus linear change. And I think the next 10 years is going to be packed of a worth of about 100 years of
massive change,
Of advancement, from an analog standpoint versus where we are in this new digital age.
I'm sure we could do this for hours, but we really should wrap it up. Ben, you are very much appreciate you as a guest. Enjoy talking to you always. You are at Existential on Twitter. It's at EXIS10IAL on Twitter.
No. Yeah, it's EXIS10TIAL.
Oh, but, good call.
That's okay though. That's okay. Don't follow me on Twitter. Don't follow me on Twitter. I people just argue with me on Twitter, so don't follow me on Twitter.
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to make you. Well, you corrected it, so I tried to throw him off the trail for you, and you fixed that or corrected that. So
I was just getting a kick out of it because you generally spell it that way. But no, it's cool. And always great being with you guys. It's always a ton of fun. And in fact, it's cool to be back on an old school podcast. Like I said, been in this clubhouse space. And you guys, if you haven't checked it out, you really ought to. But it's going to be disruptive. I mean, Twitter is going to add Twitter Spaces, which is going to be a similar technology. But all of these kinds of conversations, if you can imagine augmenting it with others that can chime in and ask questions, it'll be an interesting platform. But in the meantime, that's why I love coming here and talking with you guys. It has been a while, so I really appreciate you guys bringing me back, and it was fun catching up.
Good having you.
Yeah, so, always.
All right, bud. We will talk to you soon. Thank you, Market Ben and Jim. It was good to hang out with you.
Likewise.
Hope we all learned a little bit here today, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Sounds good. Happy Easter, everyone. You'll be hearing this on Easter Sunday if you listen to the day we downloaded it. We are at Whiskey Congress on Instagram and Twitter. We're done.